questions, let me get back to a nicer photo here. This was taken almost exactly 3 years ago to the day. Often the air quality is not nearly as nice. Yeah.
Thank you very much for a fascinating description of something that I've been longing to find out since I worked at the Nepalese embassy back in that very time period.
Oh my gosh.
Not in Nepal, but in Germany. One of the gathering points of all these lovely tourists, I was working there between 69 and 72, and my duties encompassed being information officer, which meant sending out brochures to those who were inquiring and processing the visas. The types of visas and the types of people that were applying at that time in Germany, because we handled the Scandinavian countries, Germany, and I don't know where the tourists from France went, I don't think I remember it. And we used to get large requests from Berkeley, Mountain View Travel, who I met later on, and I happened to live in Berkeley a few years later on. The types of tourists the types of visas that I saw seemed not to be hippie types, especially from Scandinavia. They were just regular, normal-looking people. You'd get groups of 10 to 20. And then there were individuals who I was amazed were going overland, Germany, Afghanistan, that whole route. So my question to you, and I also happened to be there at the time when King Mahendra died and King Virendra took over.
Wait, were you in Nepal? Or?
I was actually in Germany in the Nepalese embassy. And
Nepalese
they hired
embassy.
Me because I'm German, you see. We had sort of a Tower of Babel going on because the Nepalese would speak Nepalese to each other. They would speak English to me. I would speak German to the incoming people. And then we had a Greek driver. And then I happened to be Lithuanian, so I talked Lithuanian to my husband. So we had all these things going on. You know, it was a lot of fun. My question to you would be, in terms of the impact of the tourists during that, let's say, that period of when things started to suddenly change, late 60s, early 70s, the hippie tourists, would you say, were the larger majority? Because the ones we saw didn't seem of that ilk.
Right.
Well, so, and where did those folks go? They must have been, I can't imagine them staying in some of the places you located, although who knows?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, and it's one that I'm struggling with, too, because part of what I'm trying to figure out is, who were these people that were visiting, and what do I mean by hippie? You know, I can talk to two Nepalese who lived through the period, and one will tell me that, oh, only about 5% of the people were hippies. And the next guy will say, they were all hippies. And I have hotel owners describing how people would show up at their hotels dressed in, looking like respectable people. They'd come out of their hotel rooms looking like hippies. Other people have described how they left Europe wearing jeans and a t-shirt looking respectable, and they arrived in Kathmandu wearing an Afghan coat and long hair, and in other words, many of these people were transformed on the road, and like you said, many of them went overland. I mean, especially until the around 1972, when air travel costs went down, probably around half of these people were coming overland. And you could take a bus from London to Kathmandu, and it took about 4 months, and it cost, depending on how luxurious it was, it would, you'd get it for $100 or $300. A lot of people had their own vehicles. The other thing I'm guessing is that the kind of people that came who thought as far in advance to get a visa from you in Germany were probably not the real laissez-faire hippies,
right,
because you could also get your visa at the border, which is what a lot of people did.
These seem to be more mature people. I know, in my eyes then I was fairly young, so they all look mature to me, but
okay.
I mean, they did not strike me as all being part of the youth culture.
Okay.
The
other thing that's happening, though, is, as I mentioned, this talk only is dealing with the budget tourists. There's also another layer at the top of rich tourists, of kind of middle class, elderly. in the 1950s, Kathmandu was a real prestige destination for the international jet set. And, you know, the hotel rosters include Rockefellers and Ingrid Bergman and Clark Gable and you name it. It's an incredible group of people. But Kathmandu was a trophy destination for rich people. And these would mainly fly in, spend two or three days, fly out, and they would stay in their little tourist bubbles, which were the two or three elite hotels. And in terms of numbers in the early years, there were more of that kind of tourists coming to Nepal. But in terms of actual days in country, by far the greatest were these kids on a budget. Because these are people that would stay, like I said, for months or years. I mean, there were people that stayed, actually, there are people that are still there. That have been there for 40 years. So, but the question of who is a hippie and who isn't, this is a very murky area, and it's partly in the eyes of the beholder. You know, I have other people telling me, well, I might have looked like a hippie, but I wasn't. Oh, thanks, you know. Yeah.
That was very fascinating. I was curious about what happened to those Pig Alley and Freak Street people as the center of gravity shifted.
Right.
And what is the really, long-term effect on untouchables and the lower caste people?
Yes.
That is one. Second, this indicates the real powerful impact of foreign, people getting into the closed economy. And I was thinking about, Japan, which was closed for a long period of time, and there was a huge social change after that. And I was curious about how other cities in the same kind of situation react to that kind of a foreign power sources. So those are the two questions I asked.
Well, the second question is, what is the impact of tourism? That's too big to answer right now, but I will try to, we can talk about it, but the first one I can say a bit more about. The question was, what happened to these earlier centers like Pig Alley and Freak Street, and what happened to the lower caste people? Number one, a lot of these businesses, both in Marahiti and in Freak Street, relocated to Tamil. So there are a dozen or more restaurants that first existed in Freak Street and even in Marahiti that are now in Tamil. The Yin and Yang is still there. You can go to the Yin and Yang restaurant, but it's not where it used to be. So when the center of gravity shifted, a lot of these merchants who were more successful simply reinvested, built new facilities, and are going well. Now, the caste question is an interesting one, because I didn't have time to tell the full story of Bishnu Shahi, of Bishnu's Chai and Pie, because when he started his business, he was down there along in the untouchable neighborhood, but by around it's hard to give dates exactly, but he figures it's probably around 1969 or so, he moved his business up into the Marahiti area, right across the street from the Camp Hotel. The problem was he didn't own land there. He had to rent. And he complains that his landlords, who were upper caste Newars, discriminated against him. They tried to cheat him. They took advantage of him. And He describes his experience as one of being abused and persecuted because of his low caste background. He eventually then, in the mid-70s, also relocated yet again up onto Freak Street, and again had the same experience of troubles. And he was always a little bit behind the curve. And so by 1978, he had given up. Even though he was the pioneer, he couldn't make any, because he had to rent space that was becoming more and more valuable. He couldn't make a career of it, and he got into another line of business. And he hasn't, he managed to string together another set of careers. He's now retired, living on the income of his children and grandchildren. But if you ask the question, was he able to really climb out of poverty? I would say not all the way, but he took a few steps in that direction. He's very proud of his... In the picture I have of him, he was holding the hand of his granddaughter. And he talked about other grandchildren who he said went to English-speaking schools. They passed their school leaving certificate. They are, you know... He's very proud of them. They're going to make something of themselves.
Did they get out of that cast, or are they still?
Some of them still. Bishnu still lives right where he did all along, but some of his children have moved into other areas and are in other lines of business. And so, one interesting thing is that I give his name as Bishnu Shahi. Most Nepalis would call him Bishnu Kasai, which refers to his untouchable caste name. The Kasais, as a group, have changed their name to Shahi, which is related to the royal family name of Shah. And it's a way of trying to distance themselves from the caste background, and many of the untouchable castes have done this. They've changed their names, and this is not only true in Nepal, but also in India, as a means of escaping the stigma of their caste associations. And, I can certainly not say, I wouldn't say that caste has become irrelevant. It remains relevant, and it remains a stigma and a problem for people at the bottom. But it's no longer, there are holes in the enforcement system, let's put it that way, and there are ways for people to get around those barriers, so there is a certain kind of social climbing. And at the same time, I could take you to squatter settlements in Kathmandu where you would find Brahmins, people who have gone the other way, whose caste standing would have once been enough to keep them well supplied. Now, in a new class-oriented system, they have fallen to the bottom. So the movement, the mobility is going both ways. Yeah,
I'm a professor in public health, and I went to Kathmandu in 1986 and was in maternal and child health, teaching maternal and child health, and visited as you can see, public health would have quite a mission in Nepal. You know, what you talked about, the waste, was very much still evident in 1986. And I visited the UN and the World Health Organization, and also went to the Women's Hospital, where there was, which was considered a dirty hospital because women were giving birth there. And the whole birthing experience for women in Nepal was quite harsh. There was a lot of infant mortality. And the successful stories that I saw in public health, where they had taken the work of cultural anthropologists and an understanding of the culture and merged it with health beautifully, and you know, have a lot of little anecdotes, and I brought those back to our students here to share with them how, if you're going to do a public health intervention, you have to take into account the rituals and traditions and so forth. But the second point is that tourism had positively affected public health. By the time I got there in 1986, the hotels had to learn how to put in clean water, how to put in hot water. And that was revolutionary and greatly helped the health community, because now there was the technology was there, the push was there, and so forth. And it was, you could see it beginning in the 1980s, where it was spreading into other parts. Now, I will say, you know, the hospitals, I did visit a hospital without hot water, and with intermittent electricity. So, I mean, things were not perfect by any stretch of the imagination when I was there in 86. But I did stay in the home of the U.S. Embassy.
So are you saying that you think tourism helped bring about changes for the better?
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is what the World Health Organization people gave me, all kinds of anecdotes, in terms of, you know, I did not, I did talk to some Nepalese who spoke English, but it was like an exposure that began to spread a little bit, and I don't know if that is true, if it's lasted to this day, or if it had any impact that you saw.
Yeah, I don't know. It would be hard to pin or to attribute cause to tourism, I think, because there would be a lot of other factors that are having an impact on people's material living conditions. And you know, I would say that to this day, the material conditions you are in are directly related to your economic status. Mm-hmm. It's not as though poor people wouldn't like to have running water and such, but they don't because they can't afford it. There's still essentially no infrastructure in the city of Kathmandu. There's no sewers. There's no, you know, public water. We're talking. Yeah, I mean, this is the third world, big time. I mean, things are still bad, but of course, if you go to Tamil, there's plenty of running hot water, but that's not Nepal. That's part of what I was trying to say.
Yeah. It's still in the tourist bubble. It's not.
Yeah, and also in the wealthy suburbs where, you know, people that made money in the new cash economy have now moved out of the old city into residential suburbs where the material conditions are much better. In fact, probably, if anything, the standards of the city have gone down as it becomes a place that you rent out to poor people, mm-hmm. and you move out to your nice concrete bungalow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, John?
Mark, you mentioned this hippie trail. Is that the mm-hmm. term you used? Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, like probably San Cristobal in Chiapas was probably on that trail, or Cusco in Peru, and... thinking, how is Kathmandu the same and different from these other places on this trail?
Well, I would put it slightly differently. I'd say there are probably more than one hippie trail.
Oh, okay.
I think some people ended up going to Mexico and South America. Others went to North Africa.
I asked because I was in Cusco once, and I ran into these, we're sitting in a restaurant, there were two people that came by, and they had last seen each other in Kathmandu. That's why I was
That's interesting. How are they different? Well, first of all, I've never been to Cusco, so I can't say for sure. But I suspect that there are in a lot of ways they're similar in that these were places that Westerners projected a lot of romantic fantasies onto, and imagined that they were. For many of the people on the hippie trail to Kathmandu, they very consciously thought of it as time travel. They were moving back in time. And this was a good thing because what they wanted to leave behind was the corruption and kind of modern defilement of the West. And they wanted to get back to a place and a time where there were real people, where people were sincere, where they weren't corrupt. And so a place like Kathmandu, which, you know, by the way, is... If you're a North American, you cannot go any farther away than Kathmandu. Once you get to the other side of the world, anywhere direction you go from Kathmandu is back home. And so it became a kind of valued spot as the farthest away, farthest far out place. And it was also, they were attracted, and I don't know if this would be true of South America or Mexico, but they're attracted to Nepal for ideas of spiritualism. You know, the Eastern spirituality. They wanted to go to a place where religion was still alive, where it hadn't been killed by the corporate church. And so this is one of the attractions of a city like Kathmandu and why people wanted to live on the, literally almost live on the streets. They wanted to be a part of that life. They wanted to feel something authentic. And so there's this profound kind of romantic reaction that it's very typical of countercultures for the last couple hundred years. And the difference is that a lot of that countercultural stuff that had been projected onto Tibet in Asia once Tibet gets shut down by the Chinese, a lot of that, and simultaneously Nepal opens in around 1950, a lot of that countercultural longing gets funneled into Kathmandu. But you're right that there is now a global hippie circuit, and a lot of these people now are living on retirement funds, and they see you in Ibiza kind of thing.
I was thinking more in terms of its impact on the city, the way you describe it. I mean, do you see the same sort of sequence of developments?
Again, I don't know. It would be interesting to find out, but I don't know enough about other analogous places. Some ways, I think Kathmandu.
The budget tourism.
Yeah, in some ways, Kathmandu is sort of unique, at least in Asia. I'm not aware of any tourist zone analogous to Tamil in terms of size in any other Asian city. And why that is, I'm not sure, but. Anyways, one thing you have to separate is budget tourism from hippies, and they're not exactly the same thing, and part of what I'm getting at is that the hippie thing is pretty much over, although there are still people who want to relive that, and that's why Freak Street, you can still stay on Freak Street. Yeah.
If I could just add, to that tourist segment are also those who are genuinely wanting to trek in Nepal, which is one of the great beauties of nature, and the whole romance of Mount Everest. You could hire that Sherpa guiding book, and obviously Kathmandu is one of the starting points. Mm-hmm. And we get those people who were bringing in or requesting visas or mountain view travel. That was a large group of both well-to-do and trekking people. And we still have that in Berkeley. Everybody wants to be walking around in the hills.
Right, and that's an interesting point, because you can date the popularity of trekking in Nepal to around the mid-70s. It existed before that, but the numbers are relatively small. The kinds of people that were hanging out on Freak Street, they didn't give a damn about trekking. A lot of them, in order to get a visa extension, would get a trekking permit and then not go trekking. It was this newer breed of tourists that began to arrive. It was the Tamil tourists who wanted to go trekking. And it's a very, and that's in the larger version of this project, the Tamil phenomenon is associated with adventure tourism. And it's not a coincidence also that the Nepali state in the early 70s for the first time steps in and attempts to manage Nepal's tourist image away from the old seedy hippie ethos, and they want to rebrand Nepal as a trekking destination. And that's what they do. So by the mid-70s, the percentage of people going trekking really rises. And in fact, Kathmandu today has really ceased to be a destination in and of itself. It's rather a stopover point for people who are just starting a trek or have just come back from a trek. And you might spend a couple days there. Claire?
Thanks. This was really great. I wanted to ask you about the sort of the series of kind of subversions that you talked about, or transformations within the domestic sphere, the impure caste system. And it sounds like one of the things that you're talking about is the fact that the locals sort of cashed in quite literally on these sort of subversions, or whatever you're calling them. But beyond that, what are some of the effects of, are there greater effects than just people sort of being entrepreneurial about renting out their lower space? I mean, are there sort of bigger significances or effects of the kind of, transformation of the impure and the pure by these tourists?
Yeah, it's hard to, well, in the broadest terms, I think what it would be safe to say is that the whole kind of cosmological worldview of a, excuse me for calling it traditional Hindu notion of purity and impurity, begins to drop away very quickly. And in fact, the social valence of caste itself begins to quickly erode. And this is really the topic of my first several books that have examined that transition from caste to class and a kind of worldview oriented around a religious hierarchy toward one oriented around an economic hierarchy. And I think part of what I think people were trying to tell me is that they themselves were shocked at how quickly those things fell away. And that's why one of the reasons why I ended with that the quote about the ghosts, because that's sort of symbolic of a extremely potent reality that seemed to disappear almost overnight. There's an area just off of Freak Street. Let me see if I can. Well, it's actually not on this map, but there's a little alley that goes right through this part of town. And in Nawari, the translation would be Skeleton Alley. And this was a place that was notoriously haunted, hence skeletons. And the people told me that this is a place that, you would kind of run through it during the day, and you'd never go there at night. But it turned out to be a very popular location for building lodges for tourists. They couldn't be used for anything else, and so they built lodges there. And so suddenly Skeleton Alley was this bustling tourist district. And again, it illustrates how a worldview that had really, in some ways, dictated how people lived in space very quickly seemed to melt away in a different light of a different kind of value system, literally.
But I'm just thinking about using the space, like in the houses. Do you see it changing outside the tourist areas? Like as they move out into the suburbs now, is the way they use the space in their homes different? And like this sort of tourism-influenced space?
Yeah, it's another interesting question. And I would say that in some ways, the old logic of ritual space still is in place in the new middle-class suburbs. And so, for example, you would almost never now find a kitchen on the ground floor. You still don't. And the puja rooms are always on the roof. And the ground floor in non-commercial areas might be used for bedrooms, that kind of stuff. So people will use the ground floor for sleeping and such, or for studies or living rooms, that kind of thing. But yeah, there still is a sense that you don't want to eat on the ground floor, and you would never put your puja room on the ground floor, and that kind of thing. So there, it still exists, but it doesn't exist at all in the tourist areas. Yeah,
Heinrich Herer lived 7 years in Tibet. Did anyone, has any outsider lived for an extended period of time in Kathmandu?
You mean prior to 1950? Let me preface that by saying, in 1950, Nepal had a revolution, a change of government, and Nepal went from being an extremely xenophobic state that kept foreigners out to being wide open. And about at the same time, Tibet, that had been somewhat open, shut down. But the fact is that prior to 1950, there's an estimated number of about 300 non-South Asians ever made it to Kathmandu. The number that made it to Lhasa is in the multiple thousands. And so Heinrich Harrer is... he's an unusual character in that he lived there that long, but no foreigners ever lived that long in Kathmandu. And before 1951, from my count, I think there were about 5 Americans that had ever been in Kathmandu. The British had been there. The British had a consulate kind of thing in Kathmandu because they controlled India. But the British were the only ones that had any kind of permanent presence, and even their movement was tightly controlled.
Yeah, I brought some of the tourist crafts, which, you know, even though I was there for help, you'd see, I saw in the mid-1980s, and this is a long time ago, I don't know, I was curious as to what happened with women's cooperatives. There were women's cooperatives where women were setting up small shops, they were sewing things, they had boutiques, they were doing crafts, sewing, whatever, to sell to tourists, and it gave them cash. And I wondered what's happened with those.
Oh, those are flourishing, yes. Rest assured. Yeah, there are dozens, hundreds of little NGOs that sponsor kind of fair trade craft production for women's groups and other kinds of disadvantaged communities. And so sweaters, stuff like this, I mean, you name it, it's being produced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if there's any notable open animosity between locals and tourists since going from kind of, well, after opening up 20 years being completely overrun. I mean, did they just sort of passively accept that people were just coming and sort of work with that, or, I mean...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another thing that I have asked myself. And one of the problems with a study like mine is that the people that I have interviewed are primarily people that were children or young adults during this time. The people that were elderly at this time are mainly gone. However, I have heard stories from people who describe like how my grandma, a Nepali friend of mine, said, well, when my grandma would walk down the street, she would be muttering curses in Newari at these goddamn tourists and you know, who they thought were disgusting and filthy and noisy and smelly and all this kind of stuff. So I think that what is lost, I don't have good access to a certain generation that would have had more negative kinds of opinions. There's indications that there were. And yet the kids who grew up around these tourists, they remember it as, wasn't it great? You know, weren't these hippies entertaining? You know, wasn't it wonderful that we would go sit on the steps of the temple and there'd be these hippies playing guitar and we'd sit around and they taught us how to play guitar and it was all part of their happy childhood. So for a certain generation, they're mainly positive memories of this time. The one long-term negative impact I would say that people would point to would be drugs. And fairly or otherwise, I think unfairly, but a lot of Nepalis blame foreign tourists for the introduction of drugs. Now, by drugs, I mean not just cannabis, but heroin in particular. They blame the foreigners for bringing in heroin. Now, Nepal happens to be situated right between Burma and Afghanistan. How you would have kept heroin out of Nepal, I cannot imagine. But the fact is that once, in 1973, once cannabis trade was officially banned, those dealers, most of them went underground and black market. And one of the things they discovered was that there was a lot greater profit margin dealing in heroin than dealing in hash. I mean, a kilo of heroin is worth $500,000. A kilo of hash is worth, you know, $10,000. So it became, it was in there. Once drugs were illegal, delegalized, you get a turn in the local market toward harder stuff. And so to this day, Kathmandu has a serious, very serious heroin drug problem that gets blamed on the tourists. I don't quite buy it because I could take you to an analogous town in India that has an equally bad heroin problem that doesn't have any tourists. Who are they going to blame? No, I don't think it's tourism that is... I think it's time... These are things that happened at a certain point. It may have coincided with tourists, but I don't think you can blame them. That's my own personal opinion. Okay, thank you very much.